It's Current State's Tuesday edition, Giving Tuesday. Many thanks to WKAR listeners who have pledged to the radio station here on this opening day of the giving season. We thank you. Later this hour, learn about the extraordinary work of Lansing-born artist, architect Lebbeus Woods. An exhibition of the late architect's work is opening at the Broad Museum in East Lansing. At the top of our program today, a longtime Lansing State Journal executive has a new masthead. Mickey Hurton joined the LSJ in 2001 and spent a dozen years as the paper's executive editor. His tenure at the Lansing State Journal ended last summer amid a restructuring triggered by the growing use of digital media and the shrinkage of readership and revenue. He officially joined Lansing City Pulse as editorial director this week. We welcome back to Current State Mickey Hurton. Good to see you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we want to talk about the new job, by all means, and maybe a little bit about the old job as well. What are the nuts and bolts of your new position?
Well, it's an opportunity. It's a strange sort of title. Essentially, they're helping out the newspaper while I continue to look for another job. It's a real opportunity for me. I think it's an opportunity for the newspaper, and I think it's an opportunity for the community just to bring my skills and experience to bear at Lansing's locally owned, locally operated alternative newspaper.
And City Pulse bills itself as the newspaper for the rest of us. Are you now officially one of the rest of us, or are you still a member of whatever the other group is? That is really what I want to know.
I guess I'm one of the rest of us at the moment, and we were talking about this before, the rest of us, the Festivus season. It's a perfect time to join this newspaper.
I've always been intrigued by that. I've got to ask Burl how he came up with that the next time I see him. The newspaper for the rest of us.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, journalism in the state particularly is separated into sort of locally owned and heavily, heavily corporate journalism. And there is a vast, vast difference. I'm the president-elect of the Michigan Press Association, and I see this so clearly as we deal with our issues. We have lots of locally owned newspapers, a lot of weeklies, some dailies, many dailies actually, and then you have the chains, and they just come at it, the journalism, from a different point of view because they're able to, actually.
How should the roles of, let's localize this, how should the roles of the Lansing State Journal and the Lansing City Pulse be different?
Well, they all need to serve the community. I mean, ultimately you need to do that. And the City Pulse has a real opportunity now to increase its footprint in the community as the Lansing State Journal and other papers drastically scale back their commitment to local journalism. Mm-hmm. And the community needs it. The reason I'm working with the City Pulse, and I thought it was an interesting opportunity, is because I see their particular strengths, and their strengths can compensate for losses in other areas. Types of arts and entertainment coverage, real local political coverage, food and dining, and a voice. Lansing has a voice. It really does. We're a community that speaks differently from Grand Rapids or from Midland or from Jackson. And that voice is important, and I think people want to hear that. And the City Pulse provides that.
How invested can you get at the City Pulse if you're really pursuing another job?
Well, it's something like an investment on my part. I'm hoping right now, and the City Pulse is a small business. It really is. And the publisher there, Burl Schwartz, wears many, many hats. And it is tough, let me tell you. My hope is that with me helping out there for at least the next few months, or possibly longer, that he can focus on the business side of the newspaper, make that stronger. Because you have to have a strong, solid business. If he's able to do that, then he will have the resources, perhaps to hire me or to hire other people, other journalists in the community, and they're fine journalists who have been, dismissed from the Lansing State Journal, or others. So I'm sort of investing in him and his paper and hoping they just succeed.
But whereas he has worn the hats of a businessman and a journalist, he is able to focus more on the business side
exactly.
Now, and you can take up the slack on the journalistic
right, and
side.
I have the skills and the knowledge and the interest in doing that. It's a rare convergence, if you think about it, that somebody like me just happens to be available to come in and help out.
How did you view the City Pulse while you were at the Lansing State Journal? Did you respect what they did? Did you want to bury them? I mean, did you view... How did you view them?
They were a competitor. They did some strong political coverage. Their arts filled a niche. You know, I didn't give it a ton of thought because I had plenty to do, quite honestly. I mean, we had our own agenda there, and I followed through with that.
What was that?
The agenda, the latest one that we did, and there's with Gannett, there's always a latest. There's always a plan that comes down from on high that's the greatest, newest idea. Ours was to focus on MSU sports, politics, Michigander, we called it, and community. And this was a real restructuring we did. And we did it very, very well in the last year and a half, and to really focus on digital. You look at those four, five things, and you really didn't have a lot of time to worry about anyone else. And quite honestly, I figured as long as we were doing a good job, and we were, that was enough.
We're talking with Mickey Hurton, the new editorial director of the Lansing City Pulse. Talk to us about being at the Lansing State Journal, really at the prime of your career, and watching this transition from print to digital.
Well, the transition of print to digital has been very difficult for newspapers. They have not figured it out by any means. And you see that in Michigan, where you have MLive that has a full digital operation, but gives it away for free. You have the Gannett newspapers, except for the Detroit Free Press, that now charge, and charge quite a bit. I mean, it's $37 a month now to subscribe to the Lansing State Journal, and that's part of that is, you know, the ability to get digital. We still don't know where this whole thing is going. The problem has been, while we've made this, while digital is sort of roiling the waters, we're trying to figure out how to deal with it, how to, you know, be profitable. And the way Gannett's decided to do it is just keep cutting staff. I mean, I was looking at this the other day. I think when I came here, we had over 70 editors and reporters and on the news side, and the weekly newspapers had about 25 people, you know, working on their papers. Now, I don't believe there are much more than 40 people in the Lansing newsroom, full-time, you know, journalists. And it's not different from a lot of papers, but I didn't care about a lot of papers. I cared about the ones, you know, I was working with.
Do you recall when you became aware that the print business model was really changing profoundly?
Well, it's been so gradual. I mean, you could see it happening. I mean, the print model, let's be honest, the print model is still very successful. I mean, you probably got a Thanksgiving paper or a Sunday paper.
Jeff Bezos seems to think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's fat as can be. It's but it still keeps shrinking. The trend is inexorable, and it will decline at some point. And we've seen it here in the state. I mean, there are a number of papers. Look at Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor News publishes twice a week. This was a significant voice in a strong university community. Lansing State Journal still goes every day. Most papers, or many papers, do. It depends what the ownership wants and how they view it, how they're going to invest in the future to preserve what is the balance between the need for profits right now and the ability to serve their communities in a meaningful way. And it's how they balance those two competing forces determines how they act.
Did it end more or less amicably at the State Journal, or were there issues?
Well, I mean, I guess amicably. I'm still, you know, I have a great staff there. I mean, I hired most of these people. Terrific editor there now. The community is so lucky that Stephanie Angel, my managing editor, remained, that they didn't bring in some corporate tool to come in and try to, you know, do things better. But it was okay. They wanted me to sign a ridiculously restrictive severance agreement. So secret, in fact, that I couldn't discuss the fact that I even had one. And all kinds of other crazy provisions. You could never talk about the newspaper in anything other than glowing terms. And I didn't sign that. I rejected that and took a different kind of offer. I guess it's reasonably, you know. I mean, I worked there a long time. I have a strong feeling for that. That was an important part of my career.
Sure. So was the online paywall at the journal working when you were there?
Well, it depends how you define working. You know, they had about 700,000 unique viewers a month, but their whole push was for digital-only subscriptions. And that throughout, that really hasn't taken off. I mean, people aren't just saying, well, I'm going to not get the paper, but I will just get digital. I don't think it's working. They have this other, they've increased the cost of the paper, which is really the cost of the whole, the bundle of news that you acquire. And they keep pushing on that. Look, they keep cutting staff. I mean, we're down about, from this time last year, there were probably about 10 fewer people on that paper, on the news side, than there was a year ago. So if it were really working, they probably wouldn't continue to make cuts in the staff.
What content changes will you recommend at the City Pulse?
Well, I think the arts and entertainment coverage is unsurpassed. I mean, nobody covers it like they do. That's great. I think food and dining is a terrific opportunity. I think there's just more lively, interesting features and shorter columns, briefs, things that sort of just capture the voice. I mean, people's attention span is short, sad to say. But do we need three-page stories about issues, or do people looking for smaller bites but still pretty tasty? So I think what the paper does well now, it can do even better with, more hands helping. But perhaps I write a column. Perhaps we get more short notes. We look at page 5 and kick that up a little bit. I'm really going to talk with the staff. I've had one meeting with them, and they were great. It was very gratifying. And just go in and walk, see what they want to do, and what can I help them do?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really what it is. I mean, they're probably stretched to the limit. And now if I can come in and say, well, I can help you with that, or how about this? That's sort of the way I try to manage. I'm there to help them.
But are you saying some of the news stories might get shorter?
Well, when they should. I think they overwrite some of them. I think they're just too long. It's a lot. Sometimes it's harder to write a shorter story than a longer story.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to edit it and focus it and look at it. And they don't have a lot of people, but I could help with that. It's helping the planning. I'll attend my first staff meeting tomorrow morning where we talk the budget, talk about what's coming up. And I'll have ideas on that. I'll say, look, we could do it this way. Are there breakout opportunities? Are there sidebars? Are there ways we can engage the public? Are there better ways to use social media to, complement what we're doing?
What has changed most about Lansing in the 12 years you've been in town?
My sense truly is that the Lansing region is gaining. I mean, however you want to define it, I think it's a more vibrant place now, a better place in some ways than it was when I got here in 2001. Your auto industry is highly stabilized, and growing. Your downtown businesses, downtown Lansing, is in many ways better and stronger. It hasn't hit that home run, but you know what? There may not be home runs. I think we've gone through the recession. I think housing prices will come back. We've got the FRIB, which is a tremendous opportunity. And you have a bunch of smaller companies that really seem to be digging in and making their mark. We keep looking for the grand plan, the grand bargain. But, people like Bob Tresice at Leap, have done really a terrific job at just focusing on the important things, the fundamentals. This is a game of fundamentals. This is a hit for average on this. And I think Lansing's been able to do that. And I'm very optimistic about the area. It needs to, if it gets something really cool, something that gives it that real bump, even better. But if not, if they take care of that corridor between Lansing and Michigan Avenue, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Mickey Hurton is the new editorial director of the Lansing City Pulse. Mickey, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Enbridge is still trying to clean up the remaining tar sands crude oil in the Kalamazoo River watershed from a spill 3 years ago. Recently, the EPA denied Enbridge's request to extend the deadline for dredging sections of the river. As the tar sands oil industry continues to grow, a pressing issue is finding ways to transport the crude oil to refineries elsewhere. Some are hoping to ship tar sands oil across the Great Lakes, while others fear another disaster like the Kalamazoo spill. Last week, the Alliance for the Great Lakes released a report indicating there are gaps in the basin's oil spill response and prevention methods. Lyman Welch, the report's author and the Water Quality Program Director at the Alliance for the Great Lakes, says one of the biggest concerns is that tar sands crude oil is extremely difficult to clean up.
Tar sands crude oil is a dirty form of crude. It's heavier than water, and when a spill occurs, the tar sands crude oil will sink to the bottom and will be very difficult to clean up. As we've seen in 2010, an Enbridge pipeline broke in Michigan and spilled into the Kalamazoo River. And despite over $1 billion being spent and 3 years of cleanup, 20% of the tar sands crude that spilled there remains on the bottom of the river. And that shows us the real concern that we have if a tar sands spill were to happen in the Great Lakes.
There are currently proposals seeking permits to ship crude tar sands on the Great Lakes. The greatest environmental threat would, of course, be an oil spill in the basin. If a spill were to happen, what would that look like?
A spill in the Great Lakes, especially a tar sand spill, would be devastating. The Great Lakes provide drinking water for over 40 million people in the region, as well as recreation and supports our economy. As we've seen with the Kalamazoo spill, the tar sands is very difficult to remove and clean up. We currently do not have the equipment or procedures in place to respond to a tar sand spill in the Great Lakes.
Do we ship conventional oil and other materials on the Great Lakes already?
Currently, there's no tar sands oil being shipped on the Great Lakes. We do have some shipment of some types of refined oil products like fuel oil or small quantities of gasoline going to islands to serve. Most of the cargo that's shipped on the Great Lakes is grain or limestone or taconite, iron ore, types of bulk products rather than petroleum products form a very small percentage of what is currently shipped on the Great Lakes.
Well, can a stronger regulatory framework address this threat then, or does another approach need to be arrived at here?
What the Great Lakes need is for our region to make a choice as to whether tar sands shipment on the Great Lakes is an appropriate activity that we want to encourage and support in our region. Since the Great Lakes provide drinking water for over 40 million people, it's a serious concern whether we want this type of heavy crude oil to be shipped on the Great Lakes. In our recent report by the Alliance for the Great Lakes, we looked at the current spill prevention and response regulations that we have in the United States and Canada, and we found that there are a number of holes in our current policy.
But if the consensus were yes, can it be made safe?
No form of shipment of petroleum, whether it be on the lakes or by rail or pipeline, can be completely safe. There's always an element of risk, and that is why it's very important for the Great Lakes region to gather more information and make an informed choice as to whether the shipment of tar sands on the Great Lakes that, that provide a source of drinking water and recreation and ecology for the region is the right choice for us.
For you, then, do the what-ifs outweigh the energy needs that we have or any potential economic gains?
What we know right now is that our current spill prevention and response capability is not ready for tar sands shipments by vessels on the Great Lakes. We know that the United States Coast Guard and Homeland Security recently reviewed spill response protocols for submerged oil and found that all the current methods for recovering oil are inadequate. Our report looked at state and federal regulations in place for prevention and response and found a number of areas where that could be improved. So just like the region considered whether oil drilling should be allowed in the Great Lakes, now we are facing a similar choice driven by the economy and the demand to process tar sands at refineries in the Great Lakes. And our region has a clear choice to make whether tar sands crude oil shipments on the Great Lakes are appropriate for our region.
We're talking with Lyman Welch, director of the Alliance for the Great Lakes Water Quality Program, about shipping tar sands and oil on the Great Lakes. Last week on Tuesday, you attended a public hearing in Wisconsin held by the Department of Natural Resources, which focused on a permit application to make major upgrades to a dock in Superior, Wisconsin. The dock would be used for shipping oil. How did that meeting go?
There was a large turnout by the public at that meeting in Superior, Wisconsin, and the majority of people in the meeting were quite concerned with the prospect of shipping tar sands crude oil on the Great Lakes. The permit at issue in the hearing was focused on the repair of the dock, but there are plans and discussions in the works and permit applications that have been filed to develop a large oil shipment complex that would use the dock in Superior, Wisconsin to ship tar sands crude oil and other crude oil on vessels across the Great Lakes. And those plans would involve spending $25 million or more and could begin shipment of crude oil as early as 2015. And the people in the room in Superior, Wisconsin, and in the community were quite concerned about that prospect and whether it was right for their community and for the Great Lakes as a whole.
Well, given the oil boom that's taking place in Canada and North Dakota and places west of us here, do you still expect to see a greater number of proposals requesting permission to ship crude oil through the Great Lakes?
Yes, the economy and the realities of the oil situation make it so that there is a great deal of demand to bring tar sands crude oil into the Midwest for refining. Enbridge has a number of proposals to increase its pipeline and the supply of tar sands crude oil into the region. And we expect that in addition to this proposal, other facilities will be looking at a shipment on the water as an alternative to rail or a pipeline shipment for crude oil.
You know, this meeting in Superior was held by the Wisconsin DNR, but the Great Lakes don't belong to just one state or even one country for that matter. Are there any efforts to more thoroughly address this issue as a region?
Yes, there are. The Great Lakes are a binational resource that are shared between the United States and Canada. As part of our work, we have called on the United States and Canada to notify each other of their plans to ship tar sands crude oil under the provisions of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement between those two countries. And that would allow a binational conversation and discussion about the risks and the cumulative effects of the shipping tar sands crude oil. In addition, the Great Lakes Commission, another binational body, is studying the effects of shipping tar sands crude oil by all means, pipeline, rail, and vessel shipment on the Great Lakes, and is working on a report to come out next year in 2014 on this subject.
We'll be keeping an eye out for that. Lyman Welch is the director of the Alliance for the Great Lakes Water Quality Program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And this environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. .5 WKAR and Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The next major exhibition at MSU's Broad Art Museum features works by a Lansing-born architect. Born in 1940, Lebeus Woods passed away last year. Before his death, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art staged an exhibition of his works called simply Lebeus Woods, Architect. It was curated by SF MoMA's Joseph Becker and Jennifer Dunlop Fletcher. The exhibition can be seen at the Broad through March 2nd. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Joseph Becker about Wood's reputation and his Lansing roots.
Lebeus was born in Lansing. Actually, it's debatable whether it was Lansing or East Lansing, but we'll go with Lansing. And he was the son of an Army colonel who was an engineer who worked on some major projects in the middle of the century. And Lebeus, so he bounced around quite a bit in the States. And he studied engineering, and he studied architecture, and went on to practice as an architect with Kevin Roche and John Dinkeloo after they had taken over from Saarinen. So with that as a background, Lebeus was essentially trained and practicing as an architect before he took his own practice to New York. In New York, he starts to venture outside of the traditional modes of architecture practice and starts really working on a more experimental and illustrative kind of architecture. And so that's the work that we start to see in this exhibit going from about 1980 all the way through 2012, which is the year that he passed away.
Were you able to get acquainted with him before he died?
Absolutely. I was very fortunate to be working with him, actually. We had developed this exhibition with Leb, and about midway through the process of developing the show for SF MoMA, he passed away. And so we kind of reconfigured a bit of the exhibition, trying to avoid the show becoming a retrospective and more thinking about it as kind of a primer to his work. He's very much an architect's architect. He is very well known within the architecture discourse, not so well known outside of it. So this is an opportunity for us to kind of create an exhibition that brings his work to a wider audience.
It's my understanding that there weren't many of his buildings actually constructed. Is that so? And if so, why would that have been?
Well, actually, I think we can say that there were no buildings ever constructed. He worked on buildings while he was an architect under other architects. But in his own private practice, he was far more focused on the ideas behind architecture rather than the building itself as the final product. He built full-scale installations, some of which still exist. Some are permanent, some were temporary. But really, his work is based in this conceptual sphere where the ideas present in the drawings and the models trump the potential of an actual building. They become a little bit more potent as just ideas rather than as the manifestation of the idea. He was quite wary, I think, of the other kinds of influence that come into contact with architects as they attempt to build, such as, you know, the agencies of zoning and regulation and even gravity, you know, really could be seen as inhibiting ideas towards putting forward a grander potential of architecture.
When one looks at the museum where this exhibit will be designed by Zaha Hadid, many people thought it couldn't be built or something, that there would be problems. There were indeed some difficulties during the building process. The expense grew as a result of some of the complications during construction. It just makes me wonder about the linkage between Lebius Woods and Zaha Hadid, because I understand they were friends. It must be significant to Zaha Hadid and anyone involved with the museum and with Lebius Woods to have such an exhibition here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, the two were contemporaries, they were friends, and they both kind of evolved their practice at the same time in the early 80s, where it was almost a badge of honor at that time to be an architect, but not allow your work to suffer the consequence of corporate interest, perhaps, by big clients or whatnot. So architects were not practicing. I mean, they were proposing more conceptual projects. And Zaha's work moves out of that, and she has, you know, become internationally renowned for her incredible work. But Lebius was very much still part of putting forward the experimental instead. But to be able to put his work in her work is a real wonderful opportunity. You can see that there are definite linkages between the way that he's describing a kind of space and the way that she has gone on to realize that kind of a similar kind of space.
The work of an architect is, of course, artistic in nature, but I want to ask you about the pieces and items that people will see in this exhibition, because I think people hear about an exhibition of the work of an architect and they're perhaps going to think they're just going to see blueprints or that sort of thing. What sorts of visual elements are there within this exhibition?
Well, Lebius is perhaps one of the last great architectural renderers. His work essentially was established at a time where the hand rendering was paramount in architecture practice as a way to describe a space. Of course, in the past 15, 20 years, the computer has really taken over as a tool for realizing these visualizations, but you can see in Lebius's work that the hand is such an incredible tool. He was extremely tactile or facile with the pen and the pencil. And so in the exhibition you see drawings about 100 drawings that really range in depth. Some are very quick sketches, some are very labor-intensive renderings in pencil and colored pencil. And in addition to these drawings, we have models, about 14 models, I believe. And those describe certain projects that are represented through drawings as well, and some are independent of drawings.
As an artist, did Lebius Woods have an outlet outside of the world of architecture? I'm curious about whether he was involved in sculpture, watercolors of landscapes, anything that wasn't architectural in nature?
It's a great question because it actually draws me to clarify something that also comes up usually, because when you look at his work, you think, you know, okay, if he was trained as an architect but never built anything, how did he sustain himself? He never really practiced outside of the realm of architecture, and even though you could consider some of his work very sculptural, even painterly, if you look at his drawings, it's all under the rubric of architecture practice. Often that is debated, I think, but within the architecture discourse, he's firmly an architect, even though he doesn't have the buildings to show for it. And a way that he, you know, one of the ways that he sustained himself was actually teaching. So he was very involved in the architecture program at Cooper Union, a traveling lecturer, and even established his own architecture school called the Research Institute for Experimental Architecture. So he was very much presenting his ideas as a form of dialogue around space, around architecture.
I would think an exhibition like this would be of interest not just to art lovers and architects, but perhaps architecture students, graphic design students here at Michigan State University. This seems to me that it would have a wide appeal for the museum.
Absolutely. I think when you look at his work, you can see that the relevance of representation is very clear. All of his work is about communicating an idea. So if you are a graphic design student and you look at his work, you can definitely gain inspiration from that. It's not only about the way that the lines flow together and the way that the shadows are rendered, but really trying to put forward a more provocative concept of what architecture could be. And he does a really wonderful job at that.
Having known Lebius Woods, I'm curious if you know much about his family and how his family perhaps is responding to the notion of having his work on display back in his childhood hometown.
Well, I don't know if the connection to East Lansing is extremely strong within the family, but this is one of our very first touring exhibitions that SF MoMA's organized within architecture and design. And for the exhibition to travel from San Francisco to East Lansing and then to New York, where, you know, he was born here and he passed away in New York, it really makes a powerful statement about bringing his work to a wider audience. And it's a very diverse public when you think about the audience in San Francisco and the audience in Michigan and the audience in New York. You have a very wide variety of practitioners or enthusiasts or visitors who are really just discovering something brand new. So that's great.
The exhibition is called Lebius Woods Architect. It's at the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University through March 2nd of 2014. Joseph Becker of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art curated the exhibition. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
That is our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we welcome new Jackson Mayor Jason Smith. Also, we explore atoms on a femtosecond scale. That is really chopping up a second into a lot of pieces. All that and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on Giving Tuesday here on WKAR.